Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know
we did. We burned many things we found, too many things, as a matter of fact. This is Harvey Wasserman, back for another Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. Glad to have you with us. That was the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song. We are still recovering from last night's astonishing debate among the 11 Republicans. It was truly an astonishing moment. I watched a lot of it. I couldn't believe it was 3 hours, but I got to hand it to the networks. I'm happy that they were willing to do 3 hours, even though it was an amazing show. Although I got to say, with all due respect, I was very impressed with Rand Paul. Every time he came on, there was a sort of a breath of some sanity, at least on some of the issues. Bob Cole, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Harvey.
Hey, Bob, how are you? Did you watch any of the debate last night?
Well, I knew you would ask me that. No, I didn't watch it. I feel the vibe of it, but I really was just too spent from writing yesterday.
I gotta say, I'm not a fan of television, but that was great television. I mean, those guys up there.
Okay.
I found myself cringing many, many times, especially when Christie came on. I cannot stand the sight of that guy. And then our own Bob, John Kasich, who I am very convinced will be the vice presidential nominee. I think the Republican ticket will be Jeb Bush. And
you think it'll be Jeb?
And John Kasich is vice president. Well, you got to do the math. Jeb Bush is guaranteed to carry Florida, and John Kasich is guaranteed to carry Ohio. And the way it works, so if you've got Florida and Ohio, you really don't need much else. Everything else is going to split. There are basically 11 swing states or thereabouts, but Ohio and Florida are the biggest of them. And, you also have Pennsylvania, which is close, and Michigan, which is close, but with Ohio and Florida, the Republicans, I think, have a virtual lock on the presidency, aside from the fact that they do have the electronic voting machines. And given the nature of the electronic voting machines, at this point in time, the Democrats are going to have to win by at least 10 points in order to get the presidency. I thought, much as I am not a Republican, believe me, that it was a very interesting show. These guys, if you add up 11 really boring people, you get still a fairly interesting cross section.
If you like to do cultural analysis,
right? I thought Carly Fiorino was terrifying.
Yeah.
She's the meanest looking woman I ever saw.
Right.
And she just has this really nasty vibe about her. And I thought Ben Carson, actually the doctor, seemed like a really nice guy. I was impressed with that. But Rand Paul, I have to say, Rand Paul, his position on marijuana is better than any Democrat.
Right.
He is definitely a libertarian on marijuana. And and on war, I actually watched a 1-hour speech by his father, Ron Paul, on the Vietnam War. And, you know, I was involved in the anti-war movement from start to finish, pretty much 65 to 75. And I had to say that Rand, because he came from kind of a different place, I found Rand Paul's, Ron Paul, Rand's father, and I think that Rand has pretty much his same views on war, to be the most interesting and one of the most compelling speeches I've ever seen against the war in Vietnam. It's quite amazing. And Rand Paul is very, very clear on his opposition to the to Iraq and to the war in Iraq and to our other interventions. So I found it really, really interesting. I have to say that, that Donald Trump is a great comedian. He is a superb performance artist. And, you know, he's clearly in it for the money. I don't think he really cares all that much. I don't think he really wants to be president. But this is good for his
cash. Well, I think he's going to run as a third-party candidate if he, you know, if he somehow manages not to get the nomination. And if he does, that kind of screws up the Republicans' math, I would think.
Donald Trump running for president as a third-party candidate is the only way the Democrats can win in 2016. You know, that's how Clinton won in 1992, is that Ross Perot ran. And Ross Perot had more money than God. I think that Donald Trump probably has some secret financial issues that we don't know about. But the way it would work is, first of all, he'll never get the – I don't think he'll ever get the Republican nomination. That's not going to happen.
No, I don't think so either. But
and if it's not Donald Trump, who's it's going to be? It's not going to be Chris Christie. It's not going to be Scott Walker. Scott Walker is a really weaselly-looking guy. You know, Kasich. They will not. They won't let him be president. They won't let him be the candidate. So who's credible? I mean, really, it's going to boil down to Jeb Bush. And people say, well, he has the Bush name, which is a negative, but it really wasn't in their eyes last night. You can see the Republicans defending his brother, certainly defending his father. And push comes to shove, I think he'll be the comfortable Republican choice. That's my guess.
Yeah. If I had to choose, make a guess, too. Bush, Jeb seems to be the most credible candidate, the most credible and likely source or choice. But if the Republicans have the lock that you're saying, I mean, what is it that, I mean, how did Obama break that lock? Just because they didn't have...
Well, first of all, they didn't have a candidate from Florida and Ohio.
I mean, from a Florida and Ohio, okay.
Right, and secondly... we were coming off as
but they had Alaska.
Yes, right. Well, you know, you can see Russia from your front porch in Alaska. That makes a big...
right, exactly.
So they were coming off George W. Bush, as Donald Trump so succinctly put it last night. I mean, that's how Obama won, because and people really went out and they monitored the election stations and stuff like that. I don't think they're going to do that for Hillary Clinton. We'll see. But she has zero charisma. And, a lot of baggage. Obama came in without much baggage. And, I think there was a...
Right, they weren't prepared to destroy him. Except with his birth certificate thing and whatever. But it wasn't much.
He didn't have much of a track record, which was to his advantage.
Yeah, right.
He was a great speaker. He ran two brilliant campaigns. And
he kind of had the whole world voting for him.
Right.
Especially in 2008.
A fresh face.
Yeah.
And he could make a three-point shot. I will never forget, there was a moment, I don't know if you remember this, Bob. I'm talking to Bob Poehler, by the way. I'm just having a talk with my buddy here. Bob Poehler is one of the great writers, K-O-E-H, player. One of the great writers in our country. He writes a beautiful column called Common Wonders. I want him on the show because he's been talking about the for so many. I wanted you on the show for a long time, actually, talking about the Syrian refugee crisis, and
yeah.
We will get to that. Let's finish this. Bob, you're in Chicago, right?
I am in Chicago. Yes.
Okay, so I'm in Ohio. We're both in the Midwest here, and our great crew in New York is coordinating this show for us.
Okay.
So, I just don't think that the Republican establishment, they'll never go for Trump. The only way the Democrats win in 2016 is if the
yeah.
Clintons raise enough money to get Trump to run.
To get Trump
as an independent.
that's
the only way it's going to
happen.
And,
well, do you dismiss Bernie Sanders totally at this point, or is there something remarkable happening?
Well, I guess it's conceivable that he could get the nomination.
Yeah.
But there's no way he gets elected. He's Jewish, for God's sakes.
I know, yes, yes. Yes.
And
an old New England Jew, I think that would be quite a surprise.
Yeah. Well, he's really a Brooklyn Jew when you get right down to it, but
okay.
He did wind up somehow in Vermont.
Yeah.
And he's old, right? He's, what, 73?
Yeah.
And he's a crotchety guy. And I'd be astounded if he has the stamina to do what needs to be done. Now, if he did get the nomination, he would take a female running mate, most
right.
likely. The senator from New York would be my guess, whose name escapes me. Kristen,
yes,
Gillibrand. She would make a likely vice presidential nominee for him. I think if Bernie did get the nomination, it would be 100% certain he'd run with a woman. And she wouldn't be Jewish.
Yeah.
So I don't know, Bob Kohler, that's how I see it. I have to say, though, I was fascinated by the debate last night.
Your analysis is very, very succinct and very, very realistic, and it shatters a sense of something that is brewing inside me that the Bernie Sanders phenomenon points to something big occurring that's bigger than anything anybody understands about American elections. But it's probably not the case.
Is the case. No, you're 100% right. Bernie Sanders definitely indicates a huge and very well-informed discontent with American politics the way it is now. There's no doubt
right.
about that.
Yeah,
and,
with Trump sort of the shadow of that same discontent, you might say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's articulate about social issues.
Yeah.
You know, he's pretty moderate guy, though. You know, he hasn't talked about war all that much. You know, there are a lot of things he doesn't go, well, a lot of places
yeah.
he doesn't go. And
yeah.
a lot of it has to do with the Clintons. You know, the Clintons' lock on the Democratic Party
yeah.
is... it was actually more of a feat of strength that Obama
yeah.
Beat Hillary than that he beat Mitt Romney and John McCain.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point.
And you know, she took the poisonous step of supporting the war in Iraq. And I have to tell you that you know, Rand Paul really made an issue of his opposition to the war in Iraq. And standing with 11 Republicans in the Reagan, you know, library, that was a pretty
yeah.
gutsy thing to do. And the
right.
other thing, since you missed it, I'm informing you, but I think this is probably of interest. I would bet that
okay.
most of the people listening did not, like me, sit through the whole thing. But
yeah.
Rand Paul's stance on marijuana really indicated
okay.
a change
yeah.
because, first of all, he's always been very clear, as his father, that they believe marijuana should absolutely not be legal. I mean, sorry, not be illegal. Right. And the question that was asked was about the Ninth Amendment. Does the federal
okay.
government have the right to override state law on marijuana?
Okay.
So we now have almost two dozen states where it's legal medically,
yeah.
And we have four states and the District of Columbia where it's totally legal.
Okay.
Right? Alaska, right. Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and the District.
Okay.
So now, here's what happened. I'm filling you in, and probably many of our listeners.
So they can actually smoke weed, bring weed into Congress and smoke it and before they vote.
Well, that's something I hadn't thought of, and it didn't come up last night.
Yeah.
But here's the interesting thing. This is what really kind of blew my mind, was that Rand Paul framed, what happened was, the question was, as president, will you enforce federal law, which bans marijuana, in states where it's been legalized?
Okay.
Now, Chris, because Chris Christie, jerk that he is, made a point of, in another context, not last night, of saying that if he was president, the first thing he would do was send federal troops into Colorado to bust people for marijuana.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, what a jerk. Now, this is really interesting. This is what happened, and it really blew my mind. I did not expect this. Rand Paul says, hey, you've got all these people who need marijuana as a medicine, right? And you're saying, Chris Christie, that you're going to go in and arrest these people. Now, Chris Christie's response was fascinating. He said, no, I am not going to arrest the people who are using it for medical purposes, and we have medical marijuana in New Jersey. So here you have them with all the Republicans, the most anti-pot governor, Chris Christie, saying, well, I'm not really going to bust people who are using it for medical purposes, and look how great we are. We have it for medical purposes in New Jersey. Now,
right.
That could never have happened. Even 4 years ago, that wouldn't have happened.
Right.
And all these other people chimed in and say, look, you know, medical marijuana, you have to allow it to happen. Which
so
is amazing.
Words, marijuana is no longer the devil weed. It's just, you know, bad to use unprescribed by a doctor. That's a big shift.
It's a huge shift. It's the new normal, to make a bad pun. Is even with the 11 Republicans in the Reagan Library standing up there debating, they are saying, look, we're not going to mess with medical marijuana. That is astounding to me. And then you have to understand, in Ohio, which is where I was watching this, they have commercials now running in Ohio.
Yeah.
Because they're, Ohio has the only referendum going where you have this situation where 10 corporations in Ohio have come together and they put on the ballot a referendum that will legalize pot and sanction these 10, and only these 10 guys, these corporations, to grow marijuana in Ohio. It's astonishing.
Yeah.
But they have said, okay, we're going to legalize pot, but it can only be grown in large quantities on these 10 farms, and we own the farms.
Now, they
will allow you to have, I can't remember, I think it's up to 4 ounces, and you can grow like 6 plants, but only be commercially grown on these 10 places. Now, they have money, these guys.
Yeah.
They have had a lot of money on getting it legalized and having this monopoly. And so in the middle of the debate, and I was floored when this came on because I have not seen this before.
Okay.
In the middle of the debate, a young woman comes on, and I had seen her. There's a documentary about her, about medical marijuana, and she was on it with her daughter. She lives in Ohio, and she and her husband have a daughter who has seizures, epileptic seizures, that can only be treated with medical marijuana.
Right. The miracle drug. Which it is. I say that non-facetiously.
Well, you and Lester Grinspoon, the doctor who studied it. So she is saying, this young woman, probably around 30, looking very working class and very stressed, that in order to have her daughter have treatment, she and her husband had to leave Ohio and go to Colorado. And she is asking in this ad, which ran twice during the Republican debate, that the people of Ohio approve this referendum legalizing pot so that she and her husband can bring their daughter back to Ohio. God, I was blown away. And this was right in the middle of this debate that the Republicans had over medical marijuana.
Wow.
It was amazing.
That is
and
amazing.
So then Rand Paul said, well, I know for a fact that one other candidate on this stage has smoked pot. And how is he advocating making it illegal for something he did? And it turns out it was Jeb Bush.
Oh, really?
Jeb Bush admitted to having smoked pot many years ago, which we know his brother did.
Yeah.
So he finally
did he inhale though?
Yeah.
Did he really see the world start to come alive with I believe he didn't seriously get high.
We never know, right? Well, listen, when I was raising my daughters and George W. Bush would come on, I'd say, this is why you don't smoke pot when you're young, because you wind up unable to speak in three sentences. But anyway.
Right.
Jeb Bush gets on and he says, yeah, I smoke pot. And then he made a very clever remark. He said, and now I've admitted to everybody, including my mother, who's really freaked out.
Oh, really?
His mother, as you know, Barbara, she is really awful. So
yes,
anyway,
right.
But nobody, the only person who jumped in and really yelled about not legalizing pot was Carla Fiorina. And she said that she and her husband, they had a daughter who died from a drug overdose. And then she went on to this ridiculous rant about marijuana being a gateway drug.
Oh, the gateway drug. Yeah.
Right. Well, I actually can testify marijuana was a gateway drug for me. It led me to cigarettes. Because when we used to get stoned on the hippie farm, I never smoked cigarettes. But they did taste good when I smoked pot.
Yeah.
And then when I decided to stop smoking pot, I found I could not, which I did, overnight, I could not stop smoking cigarettes. It was terrible, actually.
Oh, yes. Well, that's the evil thing. I smoked cigarettes for about two decades of my life, and they are just, they are the devil drug in terms of being almost impossible to stop once you get hooked. It's unbelievable, And marijuana, which I have smoked a fair amount of over the years, when it was time to stop because it was no longer doing anything of value, I stopped, and it was nothing, So
right. I believe people can get psychologically addicted to pot,
generally, right. I'm guessing they become stoners.
They become like little bouncy there. It's medically shown. There's plenty of evidence to show that nicotine is harder to kick than any other drug, including heroin, by the way.
Yeah. Well, what about
alcohol,
though? It may not be harder than alcohol. I mean, it seems like the two worst drugs are totally legal.
Cigarettes and alcohol, no doubt about it. And in fact, I just watched a documentary, which I recommend to you, Bob. It's a documentary on Amy Winehouse. Alcohol killed her. There's no doubt about it.
Right.
And alcohol is what killed Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison too, and I assume Kurt Cobain. I don't know much about Kurt Cobain, all the 27-year-olds that died.
All the 27,
alcohol
right,
was part of it.
Yeah, not to mention all the people for whom alcohol was the contributor of their auto accidents and what have you.
I hate drunk drivers. Yeah. All right, so Bob Kohler, we have finished with the Republicans. I will cast my vote for Rand Paul. He is way more.
All right.
way more anti-war than either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, and way more pro-pot than any other candidate except my buddy Jill Stein, Green Party candidate. So,
well, I have to admit, I'm leaning towards Jill Stein, but she probably is not going to get it. She's probably not going to get it this year.
No, but, you know, it's as Eugene V. Debs says, it's better to vote for something you want and not get it than something you don't want and get it. So,
yeah,
you know,
that's true. Yeah, I mean, my entire lifetime, American politics, you know, especially presidential, has been about the lesser evil, and with very few exceptions.
Well, it's like the evil of the lesser is what it is.
The evil of the lesser, right. And when I voted for Obama, especially in 2008, I thought that we had broken that cycle, and then I was not so sure after the fact.
Well, I voted for him in 2008, and I'm glad he won. I think it's very important that we have had an African-American president.
Absolutely, yes.
And I will probably vote for Hillary. Well, maybe. I don't know. I know Jill pretty well. It will be hard for me to not vote for Jill. But I think it will be important a female president. Then we need to have... Well, we've already had a gay president. His name was James Buchanan. He was gay.
Oh.
Nobody wants to talk about it. He was the guy before Lincoln.
Yes, you know, I remember him. I remember him. Yes, I was pretty young then, but...
Yeah, our so-called bachelor president.
Yeah.
All right, so with that prologue, Bob Kohler, I want to honor you and introduce you again. Your column is Common Wonders. Your book is Courage...
Grows Strong at the Wound.
Courage Grows Strong at the Wound.
Yes.
Which is introduced by great friend and wonderful persona, Marianne Williamson.
Right.
And she actually introduced a poetry book I wrote. She's a fabulous human.
Yes, she's a fabulous
person. But this last poem you wrote about Syria.
Yeah.
And it's really great, a great column. And it was called The What Buddha? I'm looking at it here. I can't see it. What was
the
it?
One
what was
from last about? Week?
They had
Humanity
the Buddha
washed the shore.
Yes, Humanity washed the shore. But you had one with Buddha in the title, didn't you?
Oh yeah, this one, the one I just wrote yesterday, called The Squirming Buddha.
Squirming Buddha.
Also the title of my unwritten autobiography.
It's a great title. So explain to us. What do you mean by the squirming Buddha? I mean, when I try and and then I always squirm because I don't have discipline. But this is a different kind of squirming. So tell us
about it. Absolutely. Well, this title, I mean, when I started writing this column, I really didn't know where I was going to go. I was addressing the refugee issue and trying to... a week ago, I also addressed the refugee issue and, you know, the relationship between world governments and the flow of refugees and what they are doing and not doing. This week, I tried to reach to the personal, which is very, very hard to write, especially, when you're writing a political column, and my column is essentially politics and current events. So it's very hard to bring the personal in. I got a very provocative and beautifully written email from my sister addressing, in which she opened her own soul, her own heart on the issue of refugees and her relation, trying to look at it in a real way. I feel what I feel, and I feel different from, my conservative neighbors, but I'm not acting any different. I'm not going to open my house to a refugee, a refugee family. Anyway, it sort of was the door for me to open up this personal connection to our collective, our responsibility. What is our responsibility to the larger, collective humanity? To the issue of great you know, need out there. With the, you know, with the refugee issue, it's not the only issue of need that is, you know, that is out there by any means, but it's so provocative right now. It's suddenly, you know, the news of the flow of refugees into Europe is, you know, from Syria, but of course, but from many other countries in the Middle East that are torn apart by war, civil war, and other wars. And anyway, so I tried to grapple with the human and personal connection, and that meant becoming personal in, you know, about myself, you know. And I wrote about a 5-year period in which I had opened my house to a Guatemalan man who, you know, was somebody I knew. He was a friend, and he was a refugee from Guatemala in the 1980s, lived in the U.S. Without ever, you know, getting legal citizenship. And in the, you know, around 2004, we'd been out of touch for many years. Then I saw him at a protest of the war in Iraq. He was at the end of the march at the federal building, and I saw immediately that he was in very, very bad place. And my first impulse was to not look at him, to not, you know, acknowledge my presence, and I couldn't do that. And so I had to talk to him, and we wound up, you know, reconnecting, and I wound up opening my house. My daughter had just gone off to college. I was living, you know, alone at that point. And, you know, and but it was not an easy, simple, nice experience. He was an alcoholic, and so that complicated everything. He lived in my house for 5 years, but it was, you know, it was not an easy situation. And I, you know, after it had ended, I was sort of shattered in the sense of helping other people. Anyway, so I addressed that issue, that situation in the column, and then I suddenly thought about something that happened about, you know, maybe, you know, 10 months ago, some, you know, within a year. We were going to a movie, parked my car in the parking garage in Evanston. Leaving the parking garage, I find a $10 bill, and I go, wow, that's pretty cool. I never found that much money before. And then as I'm walking out of the parking garage, I see a guy, a panhandler, you know, a guy asking for, you know, look, you know, for spare change. And I walk past him, and I don't give him anything. But then I go, oh, my God, I just, you know, whose money did I find? And so I walk back to him. But instead of giving him the $10 bill that I found in the parking garage, I gave him $1. So I still came out $9 ahead. And as I was heading back to the movie theater, I love the Buddha. I to the extent that I have any sort of religion, it's Buddhism in this, you know, although I don't consider it a religion. But anyway, I felt the Buddha, the term, the squirming Buddha, was inside me, looking at my action of giving $1 after finding the 10 to this guy. Just felt so cheesy, and you know, and I mean, words fail me beyond that. But I felt like a grubby, selfish guy, and I felt the disappointment of my better angels, you might say. And and that term squirming Buddha sort of came into my mind at that moment. And and I said to myself, oh my gosh, if I write my autobiography, that may be what I have to call it, is the squirming Buddha. Anyway, so at the end of the column that I wrote, that I told the story about the $10 bill. and the Squirming Buddha, and then that became the title of the column, The Squirming Buddha. So that's the story right there. It's about the idea of flawed humanity, beginning with my own. I disappoint myself in my attachment to my own needs, even when they're small and petty. And but the idea was to open it up, but to open up realness and to open up other people's thinking and get further reality flowing as we discuss the issue of what is our responsibility to others. And that's the essential story.
Well, it's a great story. It was a very interesting column, and you grappled with the idea. I mean, in your previous column, Humanity Washed Ashore, you have a tremendous amount of compassion,
yeah,
and even indignance or anger about what's happening to all these refugees,
right,
from Syria. But then what distinguishes you from so many other writers is that you take it to another level. And I was so impressed with your column that you suddenly said, well, what if I was confronted? Essentially, you're saying, what if you were confronted with a Syrian family? And here you've talked about the need to take care of these people, but would you, in fact, take them into your house?
Right.
And what's the answer?
Yeah, and I mean, yes, and my sister was the one that sort of, shoved it down my throat, and but she was talking about herself. And the column I had written the previous week, the personal issue came up in my mind, but I did not get to it in the column. It was just, there was too much politics to get to address and to look at. But when she wrote her letter, her email to me, I knew that I had to take it on again and reach with a little bit more determination for the personal, even though I didn't know what I was going to say, especially regarding myself and what my own attitude really was. So I had to kind of discover myself as I was writing.
We're talking with Robert Kohler, Bob Kohler, his K-O-E-H-L-E-R, his column is Common Wonders, and his website is commonwonders.com. Where I am looking now, it's a beautiful website. What did you originally want to say about the Syrian crisis itself in Humanity Washed Ashore, your previous column? What do you want to tell us about? What do you think about that?
I'm suddenly, it's tongue-tied. I'm tongue-tied with, because there's so much to say. But what is this refugee crisis? I mean, when the mainstream media writes about this refugee crisis, it's often, as a separate entity, unrelated to anything. But so much of what the United States has done over the years, and its allies, its Western European allies, et cetera, et cetera. The shattering of Iraq, invasion of Libya, all of this stuff, created ISIS, created the hell that Syria is going through. War just does not solve the problems that we claim it's going to solve. It always makes things worse and worse and worse and worse. And suddenly, there's this flow of humanity, mostly into Europe. But of course, this flow comes at the time when Donald Trump has been speaking about putting his big wall up in Mexico, deporting 11 million Mexicans, they're rapists, blah blah blah, all that stuff. There's this obsession with national borders, so all of that stuff is what I was trying to address in the original column, plus going beyond, the last 2 decades and, what the U.S. has been up to since the Bush administration, back as far as, the colonial conquest, Europe's colonial, colonization of the world, created, you know, these ungovernable, you know, randomly drawn boundaries that then become nations and become ungovernable populations, plus all of the, you know, the horror that was inflicted during the colonial era. I mean, the genocide in Rwanda was, you know, had its origins in, you know, in the colonial Belgium, and it's favoring the Tutsi over the Hutu, and then this deep resentment exploded decades later in the Rwanda, you know, that was the vengeance, and so the colonial era, you know, we think of that as over. It ended in the 60s, et cetera, et cetera. But it didn't end. It, you know, the world's, you know, the wounds and injuries that, you know, date back, you know, centuries are still with us, still, you know, causing, you know, still hemorrhaging, you might say. So that's what I was trying to address in that.
Here's a paragraph from your column. Humanity washes a chore, but does anything change? There's only one way for real change to happen. The value of human life must supersede citizenship. Yeah. Refugees, people forced by terrible circumstances out of their homes, shouldn't have to have their escape routes blocked, either by barbed wire or bureaucratic minutiae, because they have been rendered stateless. And you talk about this child that washed up dead, a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
On a Turkish beach. What's the answer here? I mean, how does this happen? How do we get humanity to supersede citizenship?
Right. Well, exactly. Yes. And that, you know, I mean, I have written you know, quite a bit over the years about the flawed nature of the nation state as the essential building block of a, you know, of a global community. You know, nations are built on the concept of standing armies. I mean, with a few exceptions, you know, most nations have these standing armies, and you know, their the leaders are the commanders in chief of these armies. They're, in other words, they're built on war. And they're also built on an us versus them. We are this. We are, you know, the Americans. We are the French. We are the British, whatever. And you people are not. And so it's a very flaw, you know. And of course the United Nations, is deeply, you know, a deeply problematic institution, because it's not a world organization. It's an organization of nation states that have, you know, so they, you know, it's their quote unquote interests that control the action of the United Nations, as opposed to the interests or needs of of humanity itself, especially, you know, the suffering people, the humanity's non-winners in the, in the way the world has been divided and organized. So I feel that we are evolving, you know, as a species, you know, beyond these entities called nations, and so the idea that humanity must supersede citizenship speaks to that totally, with total directness. If we can supersede, I mean, citizen is the biggest thing that anybody is. They're a citizen of whatever country, you know, they were born in or became naturalized in. But why can't humanity? I mean, the photo of the 3-year-old boy, Alan Kurdi, says that right there out loud. As everybody looks at, they go, "Oh my God, this is a little child, a little boy." Not, "Oh my gosh, this is a citizen of Syria who's, you know, who's face down in the water." It's a little boy, a human being. So humanity does, in our deepest, you know, awareness of who we are, supersede a bureaucratic concept called citizenship.
Talking with Robert Kohler.
Talking with Bob Kohler here. The his column is Colin Wonders. His website is colinwonders.com. And Bob has a great streak of humanity. You wrote a really cool article previous to that one called Climbing Denali.
Oh, yeah.
About the renaming of Mount McKinley. And your opening line is, well, renaming a mountain is better than beheading it. And, of course, they have been beheading. If you fly now from, say, D.C. over the Appalachians, over West Virginia to Columbus,
Ohio. Yeah, lots of beheaded mountains there.
There are lots of beheaded mountains. There is no doubt about it. So I think that to solve the big uproar about renaming Mount McKinley, Mount Denali, is that we should also rename President McKinley. Call him
the native son of Ohio, no less. Yes.
Yes. Well, of course, John Kasich has vowed that the first thing he's going to do when he's president is switch a valley back to Mount McKinley.
Yeah, give McKinley back his mountain that we stole from.
McKinley. God. But you also make the point in there about the true cost of ecological destruction, which I found very compelling. And, of course, those of us who are involved in the energy issue were horrified. It was one of the most blatant ignoring or acts of hypocrisy that I've ever seen for Barack Obama to go to the Arctic. You know, after he has green-lighted Shell to come in there and drill. For no
and
reason.
Drill, Arctic
whatsoever.
Drilling, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was seriously a serious wound in his credibility, and a serious sadness in if Obama is the hope of humanity, which he seemed to be as he went into office, 8 years ago or 6 years ago or 7 years ago. This is not. This is deeply, deeply disappointing.
Yeah, it's not real. Hopey changey, as you might say. Your column, really nailed that. But Barack Obama on Tuesday will propose speeding up the timeline for purchasing and constructing new Coast Guard icebreakers in the Arctic. An area of a meaning for your column here, an area where the United States has failed, fallen behind Russia in resources as the melting sea ice creates more opportunities for global commerce, tourism, and scientific research.
Yeah.
And, Obama has this amazing ability to just skate right over these profound contradictions as if they're not there.
Exactly. Well, yes, and so does the mainstream, the media itself. You know, I quoted that passage as much as to give an example of how the media covers this kind of stuff. You know, the melting sea ice as an opportunity for commerce and tourism. Oh my God! But good point. As climate change, shatters the ecosystem that makes, human life possible, it's a hell of a news story. It's a hell of a tourist attraction. And, those that are rich enough to be able to be tourists can maybe hang on a little longer than those that are just needy people that have no protection against the disaster of climate change.
It is pretty mind-boggling. You also talk in one of your recent columns about austerity, the collateral damage of austerity. And I think a lot of people are a little confused about what austerity really involves. Can you talk a bit about that and what you really aimed at in your column?
Well, I mean, once again, it's the sort of thing that can be discussed with such abstraction. But the human cost is always, it's so easy to overlook. And this was the crisis in Greece, the bad Germany as opposed to the good Germany that's taking in 800,000 refugees, the bad Germany that would not allow Greece's economy to recover by, but forcing this endless, you know, repayment of debt that would just drive its economy deeper and deeper into a hole in which it could not ever generate the kind of energy it needed, you know, to once again support a population. And the column that I was writing about, that in which I addressed this, one of the columns was called Soulless Economics. You know, and I tried to look at the larger nature of capitalism as a economic system that requires endless growth and, you know, endless destruction of, you know, of the commons, of the common welfare, and try to open up the idea that the economic system under which we function ought to be a system that values that which should be valued. I mean, human survival, ecological survival, I mean, planetary survival. Why can't we have an economic system that values that as opposed to an economic system that doesn't give a damn about that? And in fact, the whole, you know, system functions on exploitation. I mean, which gets back to Obama and, you know, and okaying the drilling of Shell's drilling in the Arctic, and the idea that we have to keep exploiting and keep eating, you know, and destroying the context in which we live in order to keep growing, you know, financially. And these are the sorts of things that I was reaching for in the columns that, you know, that discussed the complete ineffectiveness and, you know, the counterproductivity of a concept like austerity.
Bob Cole, we're actually close to being out of time here, amazingly enough. Your column on Dylan Roof, the kid who killed the nine people in South Carolina, he has come out now, I think today or yesterday, his legal team has said that he is willing to accept life in prison in exchange for a guilty plea, and to, you know, just to save everybody the time and expense and anguish of a trial. Mm-hmm. How does that strike you? I mean, here this kid kills these people in cold blood after spending an hour with them, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And that now he wants to be spared. What do you think about that?
Oh my gosh. I had not read that comment. Of course I don't have any deep sense of, you know, any deep compassion for Dylan Roof. Sparing Dylan Roof a trial does not seem like an important, it doesn't seem like an important factor. I think, you know, but I am not a fan of America's justice system and the punishment-based justice system. This was just such an, unbelievably horrible and callous crime. But still, to me, when harm has been committed, the question has to be, how do we heal? Not who should be punished, but how do we heal? I kind of don't care what happens to Dylan Roof, in a sense. But, you know, in a sense I do, of course, but I'm not so much interested in his punishment as I'm interested in how, in God's name, can we heal the harm that has been done. And, you know, and Dylan Roof did not act alone. He acted in a context. you know, the context of the Confederacy and the Confederate flag that he worshipped. And, you know, and this fascinating little footnote to the crime is that the flag went down in front of the Capitol of South Carolina finally and all that sort of thing after, you know, 150 years.
At least that part of it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I think that the family would have argued, the families of the nine people he killed would have argued against the death penalty. And I think in the long run, probably you would too.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Well, probably so. Although, no, I mean, yes, I would have argued against the death penalty, but I probably would not have argued either way on it. I would try to open the door to what is really needed here. And something more than punishment is needed. I can't say I know what. It's more up to the victims and their or the loved ones, the survivors, to talk about what's really needed. But there's a huge social wound. But, of course, that wound has been there since, you know, for 300 years, too. So.
Okay. Well, Bob Kohler, it's always a pleasure. You're a brilliant guy. Your columns are at commonwonders.com. Your book is Courage Grows. I keep twisting my tongue around. What is the title of your column?
Courage Grows Strong at the Wound.
That Courage Grows Strong at the Wound will have you, will have you back again. It's wonderful to talk with you, Bob Kohler. Thank you again to the crew in New York. Another week in Solartopia. We'll be back next week with yet another talk.
Thanks, Harvey. Good night.
Did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.